Blog Talk Radio.
This is Kevin Boileau, your co-host at Epis Radio. I'm in the studio with Nazarita Goldhammer. It is April 8th. We're broadcasting from the Rocky Mountains today, and we're continuing our segment of shows entitled Junctures. And today we focus on a liberation into being. And I'd like to start then by a quick review. What are we really concerned with here? Well, we're concerned with what's really going on in the world, things we see, dynamics we see in cultures across the world. There's a very complicated structural dynamic order in the globe as a whole. We've seen capitalism grow to almost unimaginable dimensions. 100 years ago, we would never have considered that capitalism would become what it is today. No doubt, we still have pockets of socialism or socialist dynamics. I'm not saying that we have anything like a potential of socialism, but it is part of a dialectical process. So, for example, a labor union is in part a socialist activity, a socialist structure within a capitalist regime. So we're more concerned with people themselves, how people are, how we create subjects, what about the culture creates people as human beings with certain kinds of self structures. This is something that most people don't think about enough. They just take it for granted that we are a certain way. And we learn from research and literature that there is a way to think about culture in terms of structuralism that helps us understand that a social and cultural structure creates individual roles or individual positions that we can play within that structure. It's also true that we can ponder about that structure. We can ignore it. We can just go along with it. We can fulfill a destiny of a set of roles without thinking about it much. We could do that. Purpose of this group and this show is to actually think about it, right? What are we thinking about here? So we've been pursuing a long dialogue about this interplay between being and having as basic ontological, existential terms denote and connote very important features of human existence. So we've talked about how the social, the political, the economic, the familial, all come together in to a certain kind of way of being, a way of life, a Weltanschauung, as the Germans would say, a life world, a certain kind of life world, a Lebenswelt. So we have a Weltanschauung, which is a worldview, and a Lebenswelt, which is a living world of a kind of people. And as the Earth globe gets smaller and we have more interconnections between peoples of distant places, we start to cross-pollinate ideas and we become more globalized. So we started off with the simple proposition that maybe, or what if, or the hypothesis that a certain kind of worldview and a certain kind of living world, a certain kind of self-structure, a certain topology of the self, has gone down a path of possession, acquisition, having a certain style of being a self that's deep in structure that affects all of us. So we're not talking about just one self structure, we're talking about a structure of selves. And so we think about that. We think about this psychoanalytically, sociologically, philosophically. We think it's worth thinking about. So let's think about how in the Western Enlightenment in Western Europe, there was an absolute explosion of desire to learn more about the natural world, to learn how to regulate it, to learn how to control it. And so our science started fulfilling these intentional structures. So the intentional structure is the noetic, the N-O-E-T-I-C. That's the inner goal in consciousness, the certain kind of desire to perfect the world. And so we can step back and we can say, well, there have been other cultures in history that don't have that objective. For example, if you study ancient Taoism, which was the forerunner of all modern Buddhism, whether the Buddhism is in the Western world or the Eastern, Buddhism comes primarily from Taoism. And Taoism has a different metaphysical structure. And in that metaphysical structure, the world is already perfect. And we try to fit into what the noumenal, N-O-U-M-E-N-A-L, noumenal world, or the world as in itself, or in the German, the Ding an sich. We try to fit in, we try to understand that world for what it really is in the real, capital R. But in the Western world, especially with the Enlightenment in Western Europe, we had a different kind of ontological, existential, deep, profound motivation in our very being. And you know, you think about thinkers like Francis Bacon, and then a whole slew of physicists and chemists and botanists and biologists, beautiful science, and a mathematics that was parallel to all these sciences that actually enhanced these sciences. Well, what can we make of what was happening? So as a logician and somebody who studies mathematics and the integration of math and logic, sort of the basis of mathematics, we know that there was a certain kind of thinking and being. So we have this being which has this desire to know the world and then to do things to it, to perfect the world. Perfect the world. Well, we created all kinds of sciences to do that. So we can see very clearly if we're careful thinkers that what we take to be an epistemological quest for knowledge is underwritten by something else. So it's underwritten by desire, it's underwritten by power, and all the words and derivations we can think of. So we end up then with a mathematics and a style of philosophical scientific thinking that is teleological. It's instrumental. We think about things to get something else. Utilitarianism, the moral theory of utilitarianism and all its economic derivatives come from this style of thinking. Wouldn't we want to consider and think about and ponder and reflect on the type of thinking that we engage in? Of course, because if we don't put thinking itself into suspension, using the Greek term epoche, E-P-O-C-H-E, the epoche, the putting in suspension of that which we already assume, then we might be engaging in a thinking system for which the answers are already contained in the questions that are already contained in the style of thinking that's already been assumed. And if that's true, then we're just in a big circle, chasing our tails, as it were. So what grows from this, though, is an expansion, a colonialism, belief in the Western world that we can conquer the world, that we can guide our destinies, we can create a fantastic science. Unfortunately, this leads to World War I, World War II, the Manhattan Project in Los Alamos and in New York City. Really disastrous consequences of this style of science and this style of thinking. But we've never really quite recovered from these reverberations. So we take being as an ontological principle, as a deep element, perhaps the most basic element of all, being. The other element, of course, that's just as basic is time. Another one that's just as basic would be transcendence, interpreted as consciousness in the human sector. We have this style of thinking, and it leads to this idea that we can acquire, and I'm not just talking about the acquisition of property, you know, land, real property. That's a piece of it, absolutely, but I'm talking about something even deeper. It's a style of being. It's a style of like living your life where we possess ideas. I have been completely enslaved to the libraries that I've owned over the decades. I've had tens of thousands of books, 50,000 books, 100,000 books. I've had all kinds of books. I've given them away. I've sold some. I buy new ones. I've had huge amounts of books. So I ask the question to myself, am I experiencing the ideas in books as items to be possessed? Do I acquire ideas? In the spy world, in the world of intelligence, and counterintelligence, we talk about acquiring intelligence. Acquiring intelligence. And some people really look at knowledge that way. So you can have a knowledge about something without an understanding. Isn't that so? I can have I can have a technology of language, or a technai in the Greek. I can have technai. I can have a style of knowledge, but I might not really understand it. That's what I'm getting at here. Transcendental potentials for deeper understanding. And so we turn to the poets, we turn to the philosophers, we turn to the writers. Any human being is capable of interpretation. The hermeneutic quest of developing a new source of meaning. We all are. It's part of our humanity. And of course, if you look at the Socratic, Platonic definition of knowledge, it's to have an understanding about the world that comports with the way the world really is, gained in the right way and understood as such. That's my own definition. So there are a lot of people who are very skilled at operational. They don't understand what they do. We are creating more and more of a population of people who think in these ways, operational, but they don't really understand what they do, nor do they understand how their style of thinking links up with the whole. I've got Nazarita Goldhammer on the show now, and we've had this conversation, Nazarita, for a long time. We've talked about becoming overly enamored with having, with things. But it's not just materiality, right? It's idealiality too. What do we possess? And is that style of thinking really working for the world right now? It's good to have you on the show. Very grateful to hear from you. Welcome, Nazarita.
Thank you. I really related to what you said on the books. I think that this is something we should all really look at. Books, papers, catalogs, all these things that we acquire in the pursuit of knowledge and understanding. And there's a theory that most people acquire a lot of books, not all people, but some people who acquire a lot of books, they keep them because they really haven't incorporated the understanding in the book, or they've acquired part of it, but they're afraid to lose it. Like, I'm going to lose that knowledge, so I'm going to keep this book so I can refer to it and therefore kind of build my own, like igloo from it so that I will be protected from other thoughts. Like, I want to really grasp this thought and make it my own, and therefore I'm going to keep the book, keep referring to it, and therefore it becomes my own language. So I think what you bring up is really very interesting on many accounts. One is having to have knowledge, you don't actually need any books, and you don't need to have something that you keep referring to because you already have it. And I've been very graced in my life to know some writers that there's a point that really good writers, what they get to is they stop acquiring a lot of books that are like training books or other thought books, and they start pursuing their own thoughts and where they're leading. And doesn't mean that you give up books, you know, that you can't have books, but it does mean that there's a turning point, as in everybody's life with experience. When you're young, you seek to gain all these experiences because experience is different, it's new, it gives you some new little twist on a babble or a way of doing things. And you get to a certain point of your life and you've had those experiences, so you can pretty well see where that experience might go. And that it might not hold, it's not interesting anymore, it doesn't hold that knowledge anymore. It could be fun, but it doesn't really hold something that will propel you forward. It's a dalliance. It's something that you play with, a job, a relationship, a book, a new bar, a new restaurant. So I think this is the interesting part of this subject is, what do we need to actually have? And how do we experience understanding? And is that understanding fleeting? And can we keep that understanding to propel us each forward to make a difference in the world? And how do we make a difference if we continue to constantly look to other areas to surround us with security, books included, experiences? When do we grow? Or as some like to say, that what humans are capable of is awakening. They're awakening. That's what we're here for, to awaken. Not to submerge ourselves, but to awaken ourselves. And I think that this is what you're saying so appropriately. And apropos is that there's a point in experience and knowledge where you awaken. And that awakenness is, then you have to, that gives you this energy that you have to then use it. You can't just keep taking it in and have experience and knowledge. You have to at one point start to put it back out. You have to. Don't you think that's where we're heading?
I do. And for me, well, let me put it a different way. I think there are a lot of people who are overwhelmed and confused, or they ignore, or they just simply don't understand what's going on. We live in this structure, permeates our beings, creates subjects, it creates who we are. That's an interesting notion. Most people find that way of talking kind of awkward and bizarre. But it's our culture and our structure that creates selves. That's where selves come from. They don't come from some planet in outer space. They don't come from God. Either they come from culture. You come from a set of parents. You were born. You have a physical body. You have all of these elements of your facticity that you carry along with you. So people, a lot of folks just assume that things are the way they are, and they ignore that we actually do have an element of possibility. That's where freedom comes from. Freedom is the ability to change things, to have an influence on the course of events. If you don't think that you have any influence and you're just straitjacketed into somebody else's algorithm or the structure as a whole, then you're a person who doesn't acknowledge the possibility of freedom. So, I'm just looking at this idea of transcendental space. And this begs the question of, like, who am I? Who do I want to be? Who am I? You know, how should I live, right? The moral question, the authenticity question, the possibility question. These are great questions. These are the questions you want to teach children and high school students and adults of all ages, that we have some ability to move within these structures and perhaps even change the structure themselves. So then I think about having what I would call an existential, in other words, a basic existential dimension, like temporality is another one, or facticity, the fact that I do have a material body and material elements that I can never change. So could be, you know, what could be authentic? We've approached this question as Rita through the years in a number of ways, and I'm just looking at it again through beginner's eyes. So for some reason, people are enamored with this idea of authenticity, right? It pulls people, I've noticed. People will say things, well, I want to be authentic. I want to be real. Or I want to know my authentic self. You know, what is it in our humanity that propels these questions? I think that's a very interesting feature. And so I might apply this way of thinking to the question of having. Another way of saying the same thing is, what is the source of meaning? What is the source of meaning? Where do I get my meaning from? And where ought I get my meaning from? I can get my meaning from the teachers I've had, books I've read, people I hang out with, spiritual guides, writing in my journal, writing books. You know, where can I get my meaning? So I can get my meaning from animals. And in fact, it's true. If you spend a lot of time with animals, the way you understand meaning or the meaning of reality starts to shift. Or if you spend time in the outdoors, away from human beings and away from technologies, your source of meaning starts to shift. So how do I approach the authenticity question? Is this mode, here's the question, is this mode of being, i.e. having, from the Western Enlightenment, Western Enlightenment that led to humanism, in which humans anoint themselves as the highest being on the food chain, other than angels and the Pope, or the Imam, or the pastor, or God, all these other entities. But where human beings anoint themselves as being more important and having more value than other living beings. That's interesting. And in those humanisms that are largely supported by religion, we denigrate, disparage, deprioritize the value of other beings. Why do we do that? And what people don't realize is that everything you do really is interrelated. It's very interconnected. Sometimes it's easy to see, sometimes less easy to see. So, if I'm a person who wants to dig at knowledge and dig at the truth and figure out what is the most real, and what is the world in itself, if I can find it, or if I can approach it, or if I can put myself in suspension and question everything about me, figure out what I want to be, what is my most authentic nature. So some people might say, I'm the Homo sapiens. I'm this type of being that knows or that is wise. Be sapient. Or I could say I'm the giver, I'm the being who's the giver. I'm the moral being who gives. Or I'm the being that conquers and wins and competes and takes. So there's all sorts of answers to the question. It's a great question. It's the kind of question that we should have in every school class all across America. Who are we? What can we be? Why do I do the things I do? Can the human anthropology change? What is the most true thing about me? What is most authentic? How ought I treat you? How ought I treat the radical other? How ought I treat water and trees? You see, these are really important questions, but they take a lot of time to sort out. So where does that leave us, Nazarita, if we start asking these questions about or where we put this acquisition-oriented or possessory-oriented thinking into questioning? Where does that leave us? What can we do at that point? I mean, what does another style of thinking look like, being very creative? What does that involve to not just have an operational thinking in the world?
So I watched a documentary recently, and it's called The True Cost, and it was about fast fashion. And if you look back on your own life, and everybody can do this, when you were a certain age, you dressed like all your peers. Like maybe pants were halfway down your butt, or maybe you wore bell bottoms, or maybe you wore T-shirts that were rolled up. But if you really think about it, all your friends dressed the same way. It wasn't like you espoused a particular style. You dressed like your friends. Maybe you were different from those that were older or younger than you, but you were a group that dressed the same. And fast fashion is part of this. It's a great analogy for our thinking. We want to try on all these things and have them to see if we are that. And then we want to throw them out, and we want to say, well, now I want to try something new. And in the East, it's called the monkey mind. The monkey mind is constantly grasping at different things, and wanting and desiring a lot of things. They're continually grasping, and the mind is like that. The mind is full of desire. I want that. I want that experience. I want this person. I want that. I want this dress. I want these pants. But in the end, those do not have real meaning. They lack the real meaning of who we really are. And what you were saying is so interesting. Where does our source of meaning come from? What propels us? What is really the real you? It's not the clothes we wear, and it's not the way our hair is styled. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with who are we? Like, what do we, how do we connect to the world? What do we think about other species? How are we utilizing our perceptions of protecting the water and the air? And this documentary was really clear that we don't know the cost of things that we do. We're blindsided by thinking that we have the right to choose all these things to try them on. But it is the ripple effect in the world that we are so unaware of that is causing these horrendous catastrophes, calamities in the world. That we're killing millions of animals every day so people could try on a little scarf, little fur balls at the end that came from a real live being. And yet that little scarf with the little fur balls is thrown in to some bag or something when we tire of it, not knowing that that was a life of an animal that had friends, family, and loves. And we just throw it away because that experience is not connected to the real. It doesn't show the true cost. It doesn't show the ripple effect of our actions. And we all know, and teachers have this experience of seeing one person in their class who actually gets it, who actually is awake, who's ready to move on, who's ready to utilize the knowledge in a way that is not just taking it in or there because they have to be. There's always someone, there's always people around that are ready to utilize their perception in a way that will make things better. And that's really what we're talking about. Are we completely mired and immersed in frivolous pursuits and trivial happiness where we don't see what our real purpose is in the world? What is our purpose? That is directly linked to who am I? What is our purpose? Are we meant to just lead a life of pleasure? Is that, some people think that's true. Like we have this life, we should just enjoy pleasure as much as possible, avoid pain, avoid suffering, and do whatever we want to do. But that links back to who are you? Who are you? And if you look at who are you, you have to say, what am I here for? When you, I think that's where we're going. It's all those timeless questions. Who am I? Where am I going?
Well, let me throw something else. Part of my research, which I can never get away from, is evolutionary biology. I think it's a fascinating science. And we think about things in the human population or aspects of humanity or human beings that are selected for in evolutionary processes. And I am sure that there's somebody out there doing some amazing work, because I'm so stretched very thin in my own research. I haven't had time to look at it. But I have a hypothesis that right now evolution is not selecting for empathy. And that is, it is a disaster. In other words, your fitness for survival, your survival ability as a human being could be greater if you don't have empathy. That's why we see, and what I'm about to say, I do have a lot of knowledge in, We see rise of sociopathic individuals, psychopathic individuals, at alarming rates. I mean, seriously, just people who do not fit well in any kind of a group. Whole different discussion. But right now, I just looked at a video. A bunch of teenage boys just beat a kangaroo to death in Western Australia, and they left. So that is not only a lack of empathy, but that is a sadism in their self-structure. We have a lot of people with complacence. And as you know, Nazarita, you and I have been developing this topological psychoanalytic structure of the new human. We see complacency, people who just don't care that much. It's too hard to care. They usually have families and jobs, and they're just usually just too busy with their own projects to be anything but complacent. We see those who are the self-deceptive, and they outright deny some of these things, and they know about it. Or the obscurantist, who works so hard at not even knowing, so there's really no lie to tell. Or the sadist. But I know I've seen now hundreds of videos of men in Asian countries taking dogs off the street, stealing them, and throwing them into boiling pots of water, totally alive, or hanging them on a line and beating them for hours, breaking every bone in their body, and looking at it like it's not a sentient being with feelings. Sadism is very dangerous, but complacency might be just as dangerous or more dangerous. So the reason I'm bringing this up is because we are so, it's like a virus, but we have been so inebriated with this idea of human expansion, colonialism, acquisition, possession, and we put it in all sorts of words, fancy words like, semester at sea around the world, or go on an exciting European vacation, or go to the South Pacific, all these sorts of things. But they're a way to acquire experience. We have millions and millions of people going to Yellowstone National Park. There's too many people going to the park. They ruin the park. They piss, they shit. They tax the resources. They throw garbage everywhere. And all to see the spectacle of the wolves and the bears and the geysers, pictures. But it's about possessing experience now. People in Silicon Valley like to possess a zip code, a certain type of house, a style, a street address, a certain job in a certain company, a certain kind of 401k plan, a certain kind of vacation structure, a certain kind of spouse, your kids have to go to a certain kind of school, et cetera, et cetera. And it's about possessing certain identity features or experiences to fill an egocentric topology. It's egocentric. We're filling something that's empty. And so here's the link now. People will buy products from violence towards animals. Fantastic leather clothes, leather shoes. Well, I can tell you that leather coat came from the perpetration of misery and violence on a sentient being. You're wearing the product of violence. We are very adept at changing language. People in Montana and Wyoming say, and Idaho say, we harvested 150 wolves last year instead of we murdered 150 wolves last year. It's a euphemism. It's a shift in language. And so all that shift in language does is it brings us further away from this knowledge of what we're doing, having. I have a boyfriend, I have a girlfriend, I have a wife, I have a husband, I have children, I have a business, I have a job, I have a 401k plan, I have a vacation home in Aspen, these sorts of things. I have a big library. And I'm not, the listener by now should understand that we're not denigrating certain things. It's the way that we inhabit the world. It's the way that we are in being that we need to be careful of. And right now, this style of instrumentalized thinking, where productivity and efficiency and profits are becoming a value system unto itself and regulating all other values and all other value systems, this brings us to a very dangerous place. And the dangerous place is that we're alienated from all of these other existential dimensions of our experience on this planet. That's the problem. And it is the authenticity question. And I do believe that, I speculate, but I do believe at a certain point in time, more of the first world culture will completely dispense with the dialectic between capitalism and socialism, commodification, private enterprise, holding money, holding your stack of money, and all that comes with it, the way of thinking that we do things. You know, we regularly ship millions of primates around the world to be experimented on, so that a research company can have awards and can have published research that they purport saves human lives at the cost of other primate lives. It's all about having more research grants and hiring more brilliant young PhDs who actually have no knowledge of what's going on and how they become parties to a destructive system. Nazarita, do you have any additional comments you'd like to make in our remaining minute?
I think that inside we are caught on the outside from social media and all those marketing things to be something that we are not. We all want to be loved. We want to love. We want to be trusted. We want to trust. We want to be valued. And we want to value others. And yet, it's like that game where you say something to someone next to you, and by the time it gets around the circle, it is totally distorted into something that is unrecognizable from what you said originally. That's the way our culture is. You could want something and desire authenticity to be something that really loves and is kind and valued and trusts. And yet by the time it comes out, it is distorted. And we start to take others' lives. We start to hurt others. And I think that we are disappointed.
Thank you, Nazarita. We're moving to the close of our show. I want to thank Nazarita Goldhammer from being co-host of Epis Radio, everybody who comes and listens regularly. We've been doing this show for almost 6 years now, every week. This is Kevin Boileau, co-host of Epis Radio, thanking everybody, wishing you all a good week, and we'll be back next Tuesday.